Is a radical generosity and donate to WBFW, a medium that has contributed so much to improve the life of so many through our music and message program. Donations can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. Your end-of-year gift is essential to WPFW's ability to continue to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Why are Chairman Omali Yesitela and the Uhuru 3 facing a sentencing hearing on December 16th after winning an historic victory? International Human Rights Day is commemorated in December during the discussion, and Montgomery County Executive retaliates against activists. Let's talk about how you can help. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marcia Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. I'm joined today by a committed activist, actually based in Argentina, Ari Gutman. Ari has been deeply involved in the fight to stop the desecration of Moses African Cemetery, as well as international struggles. I'm pleased to welcome him as a co-host today. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning, Marcia. How's it going?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for joining us today. I'm looking forward to co-hosting the program with you. Later, you will interview Jill Clark Galab. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yep. Later on in the show, I'll be interviewing Jill Clark Galab, a peace and justice activist in Maryland and Virginia and the coordinator of the Americas Without Sanctions campaign, which was launched in 2023 and is now part of the larger Sanctions Kill Coalition. Jill is also a member of Friends of Latin America, the Nicaragua Solidarity Coalition, and Venezuela Solidarity Network. She has published articles in the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, Counterpunch, Oricono Tribune, Popular Resistance, and the Alliance for Global Justice. I'll be interviewing Jill about the work the Americas Without Sanctions campaign is doing to prepare for International Human Rights Day, which has been celebrated for the past 76 years on December 10th. So stay tuned for that interview.
Wow, I'm looking forward to that discussion. Thanks a lot. Our first guest this morning is Chairman Omali Yesitela, Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. And quite frankly, as I think most WPFW listeners know, is one of my personal heroes. Good morning, Chairman Omali. Welcome back to What's at Stake.
Uhuru, and good morning to you, and thank you so very much for having me here with these incredible forces that you're going to be talking
to. Thank you. Before we discuss the upcoming sentencing hearing on December 16th in Tampa, Florida, could you please provide maybe a summary of the goals of the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru movement, and then a summary of what happened on July 29th, 2022.
Well, the goals of the African People's Socialist Party is to reunite the struggle of African people for the total, absolute, unconditional liberation and unification of Africa and African people worldwide. And we exist not only in the United States, but we are in various places throughout the continent of Africa. We are in a few places in the Caribbean, and also we are particularly concentrated in England and France, and with people who work with us under our influence in various other places, Sweden and various other places on the continent of Europe. So our objective is a total, absolute, unconditional liberation and unification of Africa and African people globally.
And for those who haven't really focused in on what happened to you and your colleagues, could you speak to talk about what happened during the FBI assault on you, your family, and members of the Uhuru movement.
On July 29th of 2022, my wife and I were here in St. Louis, Missouri, preparing for the day at 5 a.m. pre-dawn here. And out of the dark, this commanding voice over loudspeakers demanded that we should come out of our homes with our hands up and our hands empty, and that this was the FBI. And at the same time, flashbang grenade explosions went off throughout the community and in the back stairwell of our house. And so when we came out, we were confronted with an army of militarily clad forces carrying assault weapons that were mounted with laser targeting devices that were hitting me in the chest. And when we got out, I was zip tied behind my back. My wife, when she finally came down, she had tried to notify comrades that we were under assault, and she could not phone anybody because they had jammed our phones. So when she opened the door coming outside, she was almost hit in the face by a drone that was sent up into the house. So I was zip tied. She was handcuffed when she came down. In the meantime, while we didn't know it at the moment, our office in southern and south St. Louis, which is where the majority of the white people live, also came under attack using similar tactics. They used battering rams, knocked down the doors, broke windows, went to the apartment upstairs where Jesse Neville, who was one of the people tried with me, and his wife, his now wife, lived, put them under gunpoint, and held them for a while the electronic devices, just as had occurred at my house, were stolen, and various other communication entities. And then in the same general neighborhood, they went to Penny Hess's home, and they broke windows, knocked down doors, and what have you, held them at gunpoint, she and her housemate at gunpoint. And then in St. Petersburg, Florida, they had called the home of one of our leaders there, Akilia Nai, someone who had run for election in the city council in St. Petersburg in 2017 and 2019. They called her on the phone, told her that her car was being broken into, said, "This is the St. Petersburg, Florida Police Department. Your car has been broken into. Come down and take a look at it, investigate." And she opened the door, went downstairs. She was almost immediately surrounded by FBI agents who also took her telephone from her. And so this is what happened. This was July 29, 2022. We were characterized when I'm struggling with the agents who have zip tied me and who have told me and my wife we could sit on a curb while they were going through this. I'm told that later that morning, and this is going to be big news, they said, there's going to be an indictment dropped in Tampa, Florida. Of a Russian national who's in Russia now, but he's going to be indicted, and your name has come up in the indictment. And so they said that they were serving a search warrant, and though they didn't have it on them at the moment, it was somewhere in the vicinity. So they occupied my home, my wife's home. They went through, rummaged through all of our stuff, took devices and what have you from our homes. And then they did, as I said, similar things in St. Petersburg, Florida, and in other parts of St. Louis, Missouri. 9 months later, they didn't arrest us. I mean, finally, I'm saying, can we leave? I'm arguing with this guy. I'm zip tied. My wife is handcuffed. And so are we under arrest? No. Can we leave? Finally, they said, yeah, we could leave. We could have gone And they said up in the house while they were still occupying the house if we wanted to. But I didn't want any relationship to that house with these guys up in there. We could sit on the curb, they said. I didn't want to do that. So we got in the car and we left the house. And that's when we found out that other entities were being hit in St. Louis. And we were able to get some information about what was happening in Florida. 9 months later, we were all characterized as, at this point, as unindicted co-conspirators. The stuff hit the news, exploded every place. Unindicted co-conspirators who are working for Russian. We were Russian agents. But nothing happened except that this characterization was made. They didn't name us. They just named everything about us so that everybody would know who it was they were talking about. They just gave all kind of information that identified exactly who they were talking. And then, of course, what they had done is they had occupied our communities. They had occupied the neighborhood in St. Petersburg, Florida, and in St. Louis, Missouri. In fact, in St. Petersburg, Florida, people told us that they had to show identification to leave and come back to their homes while this was going on. I have a house in St. Petersburg, Florida, that was also occupied. I mean, there were scores, literally scores of FBI agents that went into this house. They were there for hours. They searched through everything, rummaged through everything, stole devices there as well. And so 9 months later, we were indicted. So it took them 9 months to do that. We were indicted under laws that said that we were working for a foreign government without registering with the Attorney General of the United States, and that we were involved in a conspiracy with Russians and with each other to act as agents of a foreign country. In this instance, they were talking about Russia. So that sort of summed up what happened then, and more or less, generally speaking, what has transpired since that time. Of course, we went to trial. Mm-hmm. We were late in May.
Before you go there, though, I just want listeners just sort of take a moment with what you just told us,
right?
Because this could have happened anywhere in the world. I mean, this facade of American democracy does not sound like what you just described. It sounds like what's going on in the Middle East or what's going on in parts of Africa right now. I mean, this is happening in Florida, where we have a coordinated military attack against civilians, And as I said to you and I, you know, WPFW broke this story. We're very proud of that.
Right.
And as I said to you before, had you made one wrong move, things could have been very different. So first of all, tomorrow is a family day. So first of all, we're grateful. We're grateful that you did everything right. But you didn't, but no one should be no one should have to do everything right just to live in the United States. So explain to us, why do you think your movement, this particular movement, was targeted for this kind of assault by the U.S. military?
Well, you know, I think you're right. This shouldn't happen to anyone in the United States, but the fact is it shouldn't happen to anyone anywhere. And the reality is the United States is a part of the world, and it is the defining part of the world. And the United States itself is a settler colony. It came into existence as a consequence of conquest and murdering indigenous peoples who live in this country, some of whom live in concentration camps today, euphemistically referred to as Indian reservations. The United States built itself as a consequence of the stolen labor of African people. So you have the twin pillars of stolen land, stolen labor that constructed this entity called the United States of America. And I think it's really important for us to remember that they attacked us around the matter of speech. Everything they attacked us for was speech related. But when the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights of the United States were ratified by the U.S. Congress in 1791, African people were property. We the free speech and that that the so-called settlers and fought to achieve in this country was not free speech for us. It was for them. It was for people who had stolen the land and set up a tyranny that they mirrored what it was they said they were running from. And so they won freedom themselves to oppress indigenous people, to oppress African people, et cetera. And the fact is that this arrangement has been something that people have been fighting against forever. There's never been a time where Africans, indigenous people, and indigenous, I include the Mexicans and other folk like that. Remember, Mexico was formerly stolen. Half of Mexico was stolen in 1848. And this is the arrangement. This is the colonial entity that the United States built itself on. And these relationships, we all of us suffer from. I'm in a right now in a program with people who also suffer from colonial oppression or who are related to colonialism. And colonialism is more than a simple policy, as it may have begun with Portugal in 1415. It's now a mode of production. It turned into a mode of production that connected the entire world. For the first time in history, the entire world was connected to a single economy born out of the slave trade and then moved throughout the Americas and other places around that colonized us all. I think it's important to say that because we say this thing about the United States now in part because people are scrambling and screaming about what's going to happen now that Donald Trump has been elected. Donald Trump is a proto-fascist. But we have to remember that the struggles you're involved in there in Maryland and in Argentina and here and various other places around the world, it was the Biden administration. It was Kamala's guy, you know, who's responsible for this. And so Trump is the proto-fascist that we should be afraid of. But the policies that actually practice that we are fighting right now, implemented by the Democratic Party, and there has always been the Democratic and Republican Party who are partners and this whole colonial enterprise. So they are the ruling parties. So what happened to us that made it so important is the crisis of this system. It's mm-hmm. happening everywhere. It's happening around the world, internationally, it's happening domestically. And it's happening domestically, we are convinced in part because of what's happening in other places around the world, because it's a colonial empire built on sucking the resources, parasitic, sucking the resources from colonized people everywhere. And to the extent that people fight back, it creates economic and political crisis inside this country. And this what they were faced with, that crisis. And we, the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement, represents a continuation that they thought they had put this thing out. The continuation, because when they killed Malcolm, when they killed King, when they killed Che, when they were killing people in various other places around the world, we were not fighting to be let into the system. We were fighting to be free from the system. We were fighting against colonialism. And so they crushed us and they replaced us with this facade of freedom, with neo-colonial puppets, not only in the United States, but various places around the world. So that's part of what it is that is the basis for this attack on us.
I think that makes it very clear in terms of why you know, why this particular movement was targeted. So we only have about 3 minutes left in this segment, but I wanted just for you to inform our audience. So you went to court and what was the verdict? And now we're up against the sentencing. So if we could summarize what the verdict was from the jury verdict and now the sentencing that's coming up very soon.
Crazy verdict. We were charged with being Russian agents. That was punished for about a 10-year sentence, up to 10-year sentence. We were also charged with conspiring to be a Russian agent, which was punishable for 5 years sentence, and $250,000 fines. And so the jury found us not guilty of being Russian agents. We're not working for Russians, the jury said. But they also found us guilty of conspiring to do something that didn't happen. That is to say, working for Russian agents. And so it's a thought crime. We didn't have to do anything for that to happen. We just had to, quote unquote, want that to happen based on their interpretation of our actions. So on December 16th, We have to go to Tampa, Florida, and we're asking everybody who can to be there, be there, be there. And where we would be sentenced, we expect the worst. Like I said, the maximum sentence is 5 years in prison, $250,000 fine. That can be imposed on us. And objective is, of course, to put us out of commission, to stop the Black Revolution, and also to take all the resources. We have more than 50 some odd economic development projects that's active right now, many of them in St. Louis, Missouri. So that's where we are, more or less. And so people can get more information by going to handsoffuhuru.org. Handsoffuhuru.org.
Yeah, now, one more time, please. Handsoffuhuru.org.
And that's U-H-U-R-U, Uhuru. It means freedom.
And so, yeah, so next month, I'm not sure if this program will be, whether there's going to be a Christmas program or not, but we'd love to have you back on either December or January to tell us what happens at the sentencing. And, you know, we're asking everyone who can. It was a wonderful demonstration last month, the Black People's March to the White House. Thank you so much. That was fabulous. And so this movement is obviously a movement that has, reached the concern of those in power. And now, as you're saying, they're trying to destroy this movement like they did the movement in the 60s and 70s. And we just simply cannot allow that to happen. So, thank you so much, Chairman O'Malley.
Can we invite people to, like, on December 5th and December 12th, we will do the second and third reenactment of the trial itself. And so we will use the actual transcripts from the trial so people can get a real sense of what the hell happened and how the FBI admitted on the stand that we didn't do any of the stuff that they said we did, that we were charged with. Yet we're facing prison.
Now, how do people connect to that?
Go to handsoffuhuru.org again, and you can get information about that as well.
Chairman O'Malley, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank all of you.
And commitment. And we look forward, as I said, to having you back. We can collectively celebrate. We plan to celebrate.
And damn right we do.
That's right. That the court has not lost its mind, and that you are free, and that we can continue to fight together. So thank you so much.
Uhuru, thank you so very much. Good to see you, Paul. Paul was down there in Florida with us, working the streets.
That's right. Thank you so much. Ari, you're up.
Thanks, Marcia. Thanks, Chairman. Every time the chairman comes on, I always learn so much. And I think he made some really good points about how we can connect some of the domestic issues that, you know, people face to some of the international issues. And so that's what we're going to get into now. The Americas Without Sanctions campaign is preparing for an International Human Rights Day and are calling for folks internationally to hold local actions. They will be hosting a hybrid event in Washington, D.C. on December 10th. I'm joined by Jill Clark Golub, the coordinator of the Americas Without Sanctions campaign, to discuss the work of the campaign and how our audience can get involved in upcoming events. Thank you so much for joining me, Jill.
Thank you so much for having me, Ari. It's an honor to be here, especially following Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela, and our struggles are certainly related.
Yes, absolutely. So for our audience who might not know, what are sanctions and what is the Americas Without Sanctions campaign, and what's the need for a campaign around sanctions at this time?
Well, sanctions are part of hybrid warfare. These are economic measures imposed mostly by the U.S., and also the U.S. ropes its allies into imposing them sometimes to bring countries in line with U.S. policy. They usually do not succeed in terms of bringing about regime change, but they do bring lots of suffering to whole populations, particularly the most vulnerable people, the very young, the elderly, the sick, and the poor. And this is because they prevent countries from maintaining crucial infrastructure, such as clean water systems and electricity grid, which is needed for hospital services. They block the importation of food. And for two reasons, they are usually illegal. The UN Charter says that they can only be imposed by a decision of the U.S. of the UN Security Council, and also they are illegal under the Geneva Conventions because they impose collective punishment, which is illegal. And so those of us who advocate for countries in Latin America see a lot of similarities between the Cuban, Nicaraguan, and Venezuelan revolutions, and thought that it would be a good idea to advocate for them together. Because in addition to learning about those revolutions, a very important thing for us to do in the United States is to advocate against these economic coercive measures. So we have banded together to do that.
Amazing. And what is International Human Rights Day? And why is this campaign relevant around the issue of human rights?
Rights Day, December 10th, is the anniversary of the enactment of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a list of rights that we are all entitled to everywhere on the planet as human beings. But as we commemorate that day this year, we cannot fail to be horrified by the genocidal terror in Gaza that is not only continuing and continuing with the aid and abetting of the government of the United States. It's truly a U.S.-Israeli genocide, and this is spreading throughout the region. So we demand that the killing stop. But many people are unaware, however, that thousands of Palestinians were being killed prior to the start of the Gaza war in October 2023 due to the economic coercive measures or sanctions imposed on them by Israel and the United States. Sanctions prevented the reconstruction and maintenance of crucial infrastructure, severely limiting the availability of clean drinking water and of electricity for hospital services, while the entry of food and medicines was also restricted. 98% of Gaza's water was unfit for human consumption, causing rampant waterborne illnesses, which were responsible for 12% of childhood deaths. So yes, sanctions kill, and that is why the Sanctions Kill campaign adopted that name.
Right. And I know that similarly to the situation in Gaza, sanctions on Cuba and Venezuela also prevent the entry of, like, you know, medicines to cure simple diseases, you know, nothing super complicated. Could you give us a little bit of a background of why countries are sanctioned by the U.S. and give some examples of how you just gave some, but if you have any more examples of how sanctions impact these people in these different countries, and also, what is the official U.S. reasoning for imposing sanctions? You know, what does the U.S. government say about these policies?
Well, let me answer your last question first, because that is definitely an inspiration of this campaign. The U.S.'s unofficial reason of doing this, which is the real reason, is because they do not want countries that depart from U.S. capitalist hegemony to be a good example to other countries. So they try to destroy socialist or socialist-leaning governments so that people will think socialism doesn't work. They kill Cuba and Venezuela with, a 60-plus year blockade, or with sanctions that cause the Venezuelan oil industry and thus its economy to collapse, which caused 40,000 deaths in just 1 year, 2017 to 2018. The U.S. purpose is really to prevent countries from being a good example. However, their justification, what they announce publicly, is generally that these countries have violated human rights. And that is why we wanted to take back Human Rights Day to push back against that narrative and to give people a better understanding of people-centered human rights. So what typically happens, and this has happened in all three of the countries that we focus on in the Americas Without Sanctions campaign, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, they have used U.S. money, particularly with NED and USAID and other funding mechanisms, to foster instability and violent protests. And when the government brings peace back to the country, they say that the U.S. narrative is that they're repressing dissent and they're punishing peaceful protesters, and that people convicted of violent crimes are really political prisoners. So when they're so busy attacking countries this way, it's hard to get out the truth about what's happening in these countries. And so we want to embrace people-centered human rights, the story that we don't get. And if I may, Ari, I'd just like to quote from something Ajamu Baraka published just about 5 years ago about people-centered human rights. He says, the demands for clean water, safe and accessible food, free quality education, healthcare and healthiness for all, housing, public transportation, wages, and a socially productive job that allow for a dignified life, ending of mass incarceration, universal free childcare, opposition to war, and the control and eventual elimination of the police, self-determination, and respect for democracy in all aspects of life are some of the people-centered human rights that can only be realized through a bottom-up mass movement for building people's power. And this is what Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela have managed to do. And the U.S. does not want you to know, for example, that in the last 11 years, Venezuela has provided 5.1 million families with homes. And this is in a population of just 30 million. Wow. If the homeless movement in the United States knew that, and I hope that we're reaching out to them and getting the message through, they would realize, wow, when a government doesn't spend $1 trillion on weapons and war and death, they can have it can have money for its people. There's universal health care in all three of these countries. What Cuba has done is goes even beyond that and provides medical solidarity through brigades that provide doctors to countries experiencing natural disasters and a pandemic. They also train doctors for free at Cuba's Latin America School of Medicine. Nicaragua has given autonomy rights and funding to embrace the culture and rights of indigenous and Afro-descendant peoples and actually deeded over 31% of the national territory to these communities for self-government with financial support from the central government. Venezuela, those are just some examples of the rights that are enjoyed in these countries. And the U.S. is party to a genocide, is doing nothing about it, and has the gall to turn around and accuse these countries that are embracing rights for people, accuse them of violating human rights.
Right, right. And I want to also tie it back to not just the countries that are impacted directly by sanctions, but also neighboring countries or other countries that might have relied on some of the aid that is provided by countries like Venezuela and Cuba. I know countries in the Caribbean have been greatly affected, like Haiti, by sanctions in Venezuela, because Venezuela was supporting these countries that have been historically de-developed by the United States and Europe, with, you know, cheaper oil and also food shipments from countries like, you know, Venezuela and Nicaragua, and also how these countries are able to support each other, but this support is made difficult by the blockade and by sanctions. You know, here in Argentina, we have a government that is actively closing hospitals because it's following the neoliberal model of the United States. And when I lived in Nicaragua, and that's when we actually met each other, the government of Nicaragua had inaugurated one of the a huge new public hospital that's not only in use by people in Nicaragua, but is free to the Nicaraguan people and free to anyone in the world who visits Nicaragua. So Hondurans, you know, often cross the border into Nicaragua to receive free healthcare. And these sanctions not only affect the people of Nicaragua, but also the people of Central America. You know, more largely, could you talk a little bit briefly just about what are the impacts of these sanctions on people in the U.S. And how it limits our ability to connect with our brothers and sisters in the region?
Yes, exactly what you just said. It limits our ability to visit these countries. There are severe restrictions on visiting Cuba right now. It's not as easy to visit Venezuela and to learn from these examples and to learn, for example, about the communes in Venezuela that are sort of originated sort of like mutual aid in the United States, but they have been empowered and they actually propose social projects, and then they get to vote on where the government spending will go, where government monies will go in the national budget for these kind of projects. So, yes, we could be learning from all of that. As you and I know, there's a very strong agroecology movement. The peasants of Nicaragua were one of the founders of the worldwide La Via Campesina, which brings together 200 million peasants and pastoralists and fisher folk, the people who really feed the world, and people can learn from that. Hope it is now still possible, and tourism is thriving in Nicaragua. I strongly encourage people to go to Nicaragua. We're going to talk in a minute about some of the threats looming on the horizon. I encourage people to go now while you can. And there are delegations being organized to Venezuela and Cuba, and I strongly encourage people to go there as well.
And we just have about a minute and a half left, Jill. I want to quickly ask you, what can people expect given the change of regime in the United States concerning sanctions in the future? And then also, how can folks get involved in this campaign, and where can they find you, and where can they join you on December 10th?
Marco Rubio has been designated as President Trump's Secretary of State in his administration. He has been a rabid anti-communist, and he is likely to keep Cuba on the list, but that wouldn't be much of a change. Biden got elected promising to take Cuba off of the state sponsors of terrorism list, which made the blockade so much worse for the Cuban people, and he never did it. Trump is likely to keep that there, and the likes of Rubio and the Israeli government are also have their sights on putting Nicaragua on that list because of its outspoken position against the genocide in Gaza. So we hope that people could join us on Tuesday evening, December 10th, either in Washington at the Metropolitan AME Church on M Street Northwest, and also online. You can find us by going to sanctionskill.org. Will give you the website of the Sanctions Kill campaign. You'll see a tab for America's Without Sanctions, and you can also find our Human Rights Week actions and join us on Capitol Hill for a petition delivery. You can also see through the webpage the petition, which you should sign and share. We're going to deliver that to Congress the day after Human Rights Day on December 11th. And we're also going to have a rally in front of the White House demanding that Cuba be taken off the state sponsor of terrorism list.
Incredible. Thank you, Jill. So that's sanctionskill.org, right?
Yes, and look for America's Wonderful. Without Sanctions.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Marcia. I am passing it back to you.
Thank you so much, Aria. Thank you so much, Jill. Thank you so much. This is an incredible conversation. And I know I will be in front of the White House with you guys in the demonstration. So let's talk offline. So our next guest have stepped forward to blow the whistle on government corruption and violations of freedom of speech. And we're hearing this over and over again from Chairman O'Malley. Now we're going local to Montgomery County. Not only freedom of speech, but also freedom of assembly. Paul Pumphrey is a veteran political activist who was a member of the Black Panther Party and played a leadership role in the anti-apartheid movement. Rebitha Moses is a leader in Housing Justice Montgomery and started the refugee movement and tenants' rights movement in Montgomery County. Both Paul and Rebitha have been targeted for retaliation by Montgomery County. They're invaluable support in the fight to stop the desecration of Moses African Cemetery, or due to their incredible fight to stop the desecration of Moses African Cemetery in Bethesda, Maryland, which is an international site of genocide. Why don't we start with Rebitha? Rebitha, welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning. Thank you, Marcia. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. You used to work with County Executive Mark Elrich. Is that correct?
Correct. I used to work for his campaign.
Now that you have experienced, maybe I should ask a different question. How have you experienced the retaliation and violations of freedom of speech? But if you don't mind, let me start off with a quote from George Orwell before you answer this question.
Sure.
George Orwell in 1984 in his famous book said, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." So freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and understanding the past is essential to political struggle.
Absolutely.
So how have you now come to experience the retaliation and violations of freedom of speech because of your political activity?
Yes. Thank you for allowing me to be here. So I wanted to share about November 17th, 2024, I attended a public discussion on attainable housing at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School. It was hosted by County Executive Mark Elrich. During that event, I held a sign that read, "Save Moses Cemetery, Stop the Desecration." And as we all know, Moses Cemetery is located in Bethesda, Maryland. I was in a room with 99.9% white people, and I stood in front of that room holding the sign. When it came time to ask questions of the county executive, before I could even speak, Mark Elrich addressed me directly, saying, "Rabitha, we're not here to talk about this." I asked Mark, what are we not here to talk about Moses Cemetery? Mark Elrich replied, "Yes." And I was also, it was a hostile crowd. They were booing me. They were not happy that I was there. And moving forward, the next day, being a leader of the refugee advocacy group, on November 18th, 4 p.m., I was scheduled to attend a meeting with the county executive with some refugees from my community. And Mark Elrich's special assistant, Debbie Spielberg, sent an email to another refugee specifically targeting me. The email stated that I was not allowed to attend the meeting, and I'll read what the email stated. "Dear," and this is the person's name, "thank you so much for sending the list. I want to be clear on one thing. Regarding Rabitha Moses, we appreciate her energy and support for these issues, but to ensure we have an impactful, productive, and solution-oriented conversation, we respectfully ask she not attend the actual meeting. Thank you." And this was sent by Debbie Spielberg. And yeah, that's what happened. And then what's going on now is I'm being isolated from organizations that I worked alongside, fighting on various issues throughout Montgomery County. I'm being targeted. Jobs I've been applying for, they refuse to hire me. And the isolation has led to several personal consequences. I'm now facing, it's a ripple effect. I'm now facing homelessness. People are shutting doors on me, and it's further compounding my marginalization.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, we talked earlier with the chairman about the strategies that those in power use to attack who they perceive as being their enemies. And first of all, so sorry that this is happening to you, or this would happen to any human being.
Thank you.
But it's also very clear that people standing up to power is considered a threat. And those in power, you know, take whatever measures necessary to try to to disconnect you from your community. So, Paul, can you also, I mean, you're a veteran political activist in Montgomery County, and you are also facing some of the same kinds of, you know, problems, you know, attacks that Rabitha is facing because of your activity. I mean, a lot of people think this only happens overseas and that in the United States, you know, we have freedom of speech. And in the case of Chairman O'Malley, freedom of thought. I mean, he wasn't convicted because he did anything. The jury said he was thinking about doing something, which is taking, you know, this issue to a whole nother level. But in Montgomery County, now we're seeing a direct, you know, people in power using that power to stop people who are actively trying to right a wrong. So what happened in your situation where you were actually targeted by those in power and not allowed to carry out your political activity?
So there was a number of employees of Montgomery County that worked in under the county exec's administration that were Black women in particular were being either penalized at work or dismissed from work altogether. And so some of the organizations here in the county decided to ask for a meeting with the county exec. I was invited to be a participant in that meeting. I got to the meeting a little late because of another engagement that I had been involved in. But when I got to his office, one of his staff members came up to me and asked, could they help me? And I said, yes, I was invited to the meeting with the county exec. And she said, oh, well, let me check. So she left the reception area of his office, went behind a frosted glass secure door. And about five minutes or so later, she came back out into the reception area and said, oh, you're not invited to this meeting. I said, what do you mean I'm not invited to this meeting? And then I gave her the names of the other two women that were in the meeting. And I said, I have been invited to this meeting. And she said, no, you're not invited to the meeting. So I decided, okay, let me just stay here in the reception area until the meeting is over with, where I can talk directly to the women that were in the meeting to find out what's going on. So the woman decided that she would stay out in the reception area and engage me in conversation. So we talked about a little bit of the history of Montgomery County and things along this line. And about maybe a half hour, 45 minutes later, another staff person came from behind the frosted glass door, secure door. And I believe he went out to the restroom in the lobby area, near the elevator on that floor. And then he returned and went back to behind the door. And about 10 minutes later, he comes back out again and he calls the woman over to him. He talks to her for a short moment. And then she turns around, looks at me, and she walks over to me and she says, okay, you're gonna have to leave this office altogether. Mm. And I'm like,
you had to leave that office at that point.
Right, that I could not even stay in the reception area. Mm. And I'm asking her, what's going on? How come I have to leave right now? And she says, I've been instructed that you have to leave. So she escorts me out to the hallway where the elevators were, and she pushed the button to call the elevator and then sat there and waited for me to enter the elevator to leave the floor.
Mm. How are you feeling at this point?
Well, my point is that I've been dealing with arrogant politicians for over 60 some odd years. And so I've been used to dealing with them, except Mark Eldridge himself knows me very well In fact, in the 1980s, I was chair of the Rainbow Coalition in Montgomery County. And that's when Mark Eldridge and even Jamie Raskin and George Leventhal, all three of them have been now elected officials in Montgomery County, joined the Rainbow Coalition. So they joined an organization I was chairing at the time. So they know me from the 1980s. And yet now that they're in office, they all of a sudden feel that people from Montgomery County should not, challenge things they may see wrong, even though their rationale for joining the Rainbow in the first place was to challenge what they saw going wrong inside the county. So it's really interesting when you see people like Mark Eldridge who like to present himself as a progressive, as a person looking out for the little person in society that has been abused by the government, that he himself is taking on the role of being the abuser, of preventing people from practicing their democratic rights. So these are the kind of things that the people of Montgomery County need to be very clear about. And I think they have become clear because when this past election, there was a proposal put for on the ballot that the county exec's office could have a term limit of 2 years rather than 3 years. And in fact, it overwhelmingly passed. So I've seen that I'm not the only one that seems to have a problem with Mark and the way he's running the county government. And it's just something that people need to be very aware of, is that when you think that you have someone who in fact proclaimed himself to be a person concerned about the little guy, and then when they get into office, they seem to be chasing the money of the large developers, because I believe his whole reasoning behind preventing me from being a part of the conversation was my participation with the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition. Mm-hmm. And that, he knows that his office has been challenged over and over again about promises he's made and then failed to keep.
Now, let me ask you a question, Paul. Did you have an opportunity to talk to Mark at some point about why he refused to allow you to attend the meeting?
Yes, I did.
We only have a minute, but so.
Okay. I also attended the meeting at the Bethesda Chevy Chase High School, where Mark was there hosting the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, I approached him and I asked him, I said, why was I prevented from coming into the meeting in your office? And his response was, well, I make decisions as to who I would meet with. And I chose not to meet with you there, period.
Wow.
So it's clear that even though people pay taxes in the county, even though people who have grown up and been a part of the struggle for justice in this county, because when I was born in Montgomery County, I was forced to go to segregated schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm seeing that now you got a county exec who acts as if he has the same mentality of the politicians back in the days of the 50s and early 60s in Montgomery County.
Right.
That he can, I doubt he would have said that to a Jewish leader in Montgomery County, or even some of the white leaders, even if they had been Republicans, I doubt that he would have excluded them from coming into the meeting.
Right. Yeah. I think this issue of controlling powers that be, controlling the political conversation, and therefore their ability to what they consider control the struggle, is an issue that we really have to pay a lot of attention to. And when politicians begin to bar people from attending public meetings, I should have asked both of you, obviously Bethesda Chevy Chase High School is a public venue. The county executive's office is a public facility. So you were actually, just like you're mentioning, in the 1950s and 40s, you were being barred from public places I mean, these were not, this was not a private home or a private business. These were public venues that everyone should feel free to come in and out of. And obviously this was a public meeting that you guys were at, in which you were being barred from participating. So I wanted just to thank both of you for being on the show. We will continue to follow up because this, to me, this presents to, it seems to me that this is a pattern in practice. And if there are other people out there on WPFW's and WPFW's family who've also experienced this kind of oppression of not being able to attend public events or being barred from public meetings, I think we should really, I'd like to know about it. So thank you so much, Paul. Thank you so much, Rabitha, for your—
Thank you, Marcia.
For your courage to stand up and then to actually come on a radio show and speak truth to power so that other people understand what's going on. So thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'd like just before we close to take this opportunity to wish everyone a wonderful Happy Family Day tomorrow. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Chairman Amalia Satella, Jill Clark Galab, Rabitha Moses, and Paul Pumphrey. Thanks also to my co-host, Ari Gutman. Thanks to executive producer, Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is being engineered by Kalia Chapman. I'm Marcia Coleman Adebayo. We are celebrating the 22nd anniversary of the passage of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. WPFW salutes whistleblowers.
Each year, WPFW stands in solidarity with our Indigenous family on the fourth Thursday of November in commemoration of the National Day of Mourning, as well as celebrates the gratitude and harvest inherent in the season. Thursday, November 28th, from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m., we center Indigenous American voices in programming, including a live broadcast from Plymouth Rock of the annual rally and march by the United American Indians of New England. Then, from 2 until 7 p.m., we present music imbued with gratitude and in recognition of this time of harvest. That's Thursday, 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a town hall meeting on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon to 2:30 p.m. Plenty of off-street parking is available. As this will be our last town hall while at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other important issues facing the station. Healthy refreshments will be served. We hope to see you there.
A better future has been built by all of us right now, and the billions of small actions we take each day, acts of courage, equity, care, love, and tolerance, all threats and the beautiful tapestry of the world we want to inhabit. Beginning on Given Tuesday, December 3rd through the 31st, we ask you to embrace a radical generosity and donate to WPFW, a medium that has contributed so much to improve the life of so many through our music and message program. Donations can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. Your end-of-year gift is essential to WPFW's ability to continue to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
We're back! WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of said event in a format that is no longer than